John Rubel is co-founder and partner in the firm of Moore, Rubel, Udell Architects and Planners. For more than 30 years now, Rubel and his California-based firm have created all manner of projects, including many civic and cultural structures. The architect's in town today to deliver a lecture examining urban design issues confronting Kansas City and other metropolitan areas. But before he takes the podium, John Rubel joins me here in KCUR studio. And John, welcome. Nice to have you.
Oh, thanks very much. Glad to have this chance.
Your firm has designed for projects both big and small in cities around the world. The one greatest challenge facing metros in their planning and design today is what, John?
I think it's how you integrate public opinion into the process of designing and developing cities.
Public opinion? Does that matter?
It's becoming more and more important. My hometown professionally, our office is in Santa Monica, has a ballot measure this year that would require any building over 30 feet tall to be subject to a public vote. This, of course, is going to totally bring development in Santa Monica to a standstill. And many projects that have been in planning for a long time that are quite legitimate projects could really stand to be just shelved indefinitely. So I do think public opinion is important, and I think public engagement in the development of cities is important, but it's unfortunate to see it turn into something that categorical and obstructive.
But the public isn't comprised of architects. They do all kinds of different things. So what do they bring to the table?
Well, I think this is one issue. I think people who live in cities know quite well what works there and what doesn't. And you don't have to be a professional to know, to not like the traffic problems, and that's usually kind of the kind of issue it is. It becomes harder when you really apply professional judgment and try to have an educational process. We use a workshop process. All of the things we do in Santa Monica, for example, go through many, many public workshops in different neighborhoods, really bringing out the details of the project and having a real frank discussion about how they would affect what's already there.
So engaging the public has become part and parcel of what you guys do.
It's always been part of our practice. We started back in the mid-70s, late-70s, with an approach that we engage people in the design process. An example was St. Matthew's Church in Pacific Palisades. We designed the church with the congregation, about 100 people, in each of a series of meetings. So we've worked out a system or a methodology to do this that really does get serious public input and engagement in the process, whether it's a small project like a church or a bigger project like a commercial mixed-use development.
Hmm. How tough is it to create a structure these days that will not only last and serve a city for many, many years? Because, these days, you obviously can't predict the future your building's going to face.
No, but we know a lot of things about the future. We know, for example, about climate change. And really, one of the strongest arguments for new development in any city is simply the fact that the old fabric, the old stock of buildings, is not usually very energy efficient. New buildings are built to a much, much higher standard. The only way we're going to really make a contribution in terms of urban development towards the issue of climate change is by both massive remodeling and also the development of new facilities, buildings, new centers.
That's interesting. The Kansas City Plaza Branch Public Library hosts John Rubel for his lecture on Shaping Cities. It's sponsored by UMKC's Department of Architecture, Urban Planning, and Design. The event begins at 6:30 this evening. You can RSVP for a seat at kclibrary.org. John, what can cities do to help themselves plan and design even better and smarter than they already are?
Well, I think there's no substitute for having a good, engaged, creative planning department in the city, people at a high level professionally who really take an activist approach. You see this in European cities all the time. Development is really guided by a process. There is also a public component to that process. But plans are made that are quite specific, and development knows what the options are, knows what the opportunities are, and it really does lead, I think, to a more coherent development and a lot of advantages both for the public and for the commercial side of development.
I want to turn the conversation to some of the work of your firm. Again, Moore, Rubel, Udell.
You did a great job with that, by the way.
Am I getting it right, all the names? The work you guys have done, starting with U.S. embassies, and this interested me a little bit. We counted four on your website: Germany, Finland, the Dominican Republic, and the Netherlands. Am I right to say that, you know, in this day and age, security is maybe the topmost concern?
Well, we, of course, in designing these projects, balance security with other concerns, and that is what makes it, in many ways, such an interesting challenge. A great example is the new embassy in Helsinki, which was just finished last year. It's won a design award from the Chicago Athenaeum, which is the first design award we've gotten on the embassy projects. It's really important as a statement of the American presence. It sits in a very prominent location on the harbor. Mm. Every boat that goes in and out of the Helsinki harbor goes right past the U.S. Embassy. So our design there had to make a statement other than just this is a very secure facility.
And the statement it made was what?
Well, it shows, I think, a respect for the kind of core central place that design has in Finnish culture. The whole establishment of Finland was an establishment that was very much tied with an arts and architecture movement back in the 1915-16 period. And I think the development of the embassy shows a respect for Finland's tradition of modern architecture. It's a beautiful glassy building that lights up during the cold winter afternoons. It serves as a kind of a beacon. And it really shows, I think, a celebration and a respect for kind of Finland's tradition of modern architecture.
Do you worry about security in a country like Finland as much as you would worry about security in a country like Israel for an American embassy?
Well, we wouldn't have until a couple of years ago. I don't know if you're, and I'm a little fuzzy on the details, but you know there was a mass shooting in Norway.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, and that kind of thing is just a reminder that sadly there is no place, no culture, no city where things like that can't happen, and this is what the State Department tells us every day on the way to work.
So are the restrictions for security just as stringent in Norway as they would be in Israel?
Yes, every project, particularly every new project. Sometimes there's a remodeling of a historic building, and you do what you can, and that was the case in Helsinki too. But generally speaking, very high standard, usually an increasingly high standard. And once those standards are set, there's no rolling them back. So every embassy project meets extremely complex requirements in terms of that.
You know, to what extent do these security restrictions place on the design of the building? I mean, would you design a different kind of building if you weren't so hamstrung by that?
You might, but, you know, it's all about a creative solution to making these things happen. It's about things you have to do and things that you can't do. And like any creative design problem, you always have some limitations. So I find it merely makes it more interesting.
Hmm. How much does the fact that these buildings, you know, John, are the face of America in a foreign country, how much does that influence the design? What nationalistic characteristics do you try to portray in the finished project?
Well, I think the most important thing with all the embassy projects that we're doing and others that the department is doing, there's a very high standard for design on a lot of levels: sustainability, functionality. We want buildings that are extremely well built. It is, in many ways, the face of the nation. In a lot of countries, the embassy is maybe the only American building that anyone will ever see. So it is kind of important that way. But we're also looking simply to raise the standard of embassy design just the way all federal design has been raised in the past and is currently. We want all of our public buildings to be demonstrations of sustainable, you know, excellent design.
Is there some characteristic of a John Rubel embassy that would stand out to people who even aren't trained in architecture? How would I recognize a John Rubel embassy compared to a non-embassy building?
Well, let's just say a more Rubel Udell embassy anyway. I think one of the things we do is we probably go a bit further in trying to understand how can that building really reflect something about the culture and the character and the region And each of our embassy buildings is utterly different in design, more, I think, more so than even other quite good architects who might be doing embassies.
So a stereotype you're saying you're avoiding?
We do each project as a unique resultant of a whole series of considerations, but we're looking for that cultural connection. We're looking for the folks who live in that country to be able to see the building and see, I understand why that building looks like it does, and also for the Americans who work there to get a kind of heightened experience of being in the country rather than just, oh, here's the building that looks just like Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Is the word stereotype, is that a bad word in your profession?
Well, it's probably a bad word anywhere. I think,
good point.
You know, don't think type or stereotype, think standards, think, minimum goals for achievement and success and excellence raised at a very high level. That's the kind of thing we'd like to see repeated everywhere,
Yeah. Not
necessarily the answers to those things.
You know, John, one of your embassies, the one in Berlin, created negative critiques, especially from some of the Germans. What were the objections?
Well, oddly enough, we designed the embassy in Berlin to really support a much bigger development that was happening there called critical reconstruction. And that's one of the things I'll be talking about tonight. I worked in Berlin for over 30 years during this very historic period that both sides of the reunification of Germany. So the rebuilding of the historic core of Berlin was a huge issue. Our building, I believed, does a very significant job of that. However, something happened along the way because of security and some changes. We had to push the building back from the edge, from the street wall. That's an architect's term, street wall. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we pushed the building back to get a bigger setback on a major street, and this greatly angered our previously very supportive urban design leader, Hans Stimmann, who was the author of the whole concept of critical reconstruction. So these things become very political, especially in a city like Berlin. Design is something the public takes very, very seriously.
Oh, that's interesting. One other tricky project I had to ask you about that your firm accepted was the expansion of the University of Virginia campus. I mean, this is just for the record, this is the one that was designed by a guy named Thomas Jefferson. You know, other design proposals had already been turned down over the course of several years, and the firm that had been contracted quit out of sheer frustration. Aside from the money, why did you want to take Thomas Jefferson on and his legacy and all of that stuff at the University of Virginia?
I did ask myself that question a lot of times, and it clearly, we worked with a very conservative committee, and it clearly became an issue, no columns, no checks, which means that the College of Arts and Sciences, which very, very much needed this building in order to maintain the incredible standard they have, wouldn't get a building, and this could be actually quite a detrimental thing. So
you said no columns?
No columns, meaning no classical columns in the Jeffersonian classical tradition.
Why?
No checks. Well, here's the thing. Folks at University of Virginia take the environment more seriously than almost any other campus I know of. It's part of their heritage. It's part of their identity. All the alumni. This is a hugely important heritage that they're all extremely committed to protecting and defending. And any new building that goes up in the vicinity of the central grounds, which is the area that Jefferson designed around the lawn, comes under serious scrutiny. So we managed to find an authentic way to do a neoclassical building in a 21st century language and managed, we're very happy with it. We're very excited about it. It probably isn't something we would do anywhere else.
But I can't imagine a Jeffersonian-style building without columns. Am I missing something there?
That's right. So columns, yes.
Yeah. So what did you do?
Well, I think that we first of all designed a building that really addressed this wonderful topographic situation that you come across a bridge or a terrace over a public street from the central grounds of the lawn. You cross over this beautiful grassy terrace, and you land on top of a round building that has an auditorium under it that obviously is kind of an answer to the rotunda at the other end.
Yeah.
But there's no dome there. You walk in on top of the building and then take a stairway down. So the students in their usual wily way, have taken to calling it the Notunda, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, but still no columns.
No, it has the buildings addressing this little round plaza do have classic porches with columns. They also, the columns also have solar shades integrated in the porch. So there's a distinctly kind of modern element right in there with the column porches.
I'm just slow here. And they objected to any notion of you adding columns because why?
No. It was the opposite.
The opposite.
It
they
was the opposite.
Columns.
You have to have columns.
You have to have columns. Okay, that's what
that's
I'm missing.
That's what I
here.
Said. No columns, no checks. Yeah. Meaning you have columns on your building or we're not paying for it.
Yeah, I gotcha. I gotcha. Besides here in the U.S., your firm works in Europe, Asia, and Caribbean countries. Who keeps track of the building regulations and codes when you're in a foreign country? And how tough can that be?
Well, we always have associates and partners in terms of local firms, especially, for instance, in China. All the projects we're doing in China are really the technical delivery of the project is taken care of by what's called a local design institute. And these LDIs really are huge companies that have several thousand architects employed and engineers. And that's how everything happens in China. So, but everywhere else in Europe, when we're doing the State Department buildings, it's interesting because we have to do both the local code and the international building code. And a lot of times they're in deep conflict with each other.
I can imagine. Well, this is your first visit to Kansas City. What do you make of our town from an architectural point of view?
Well, remember, I come from a town where there's hardly a building anywhere around that's more than two stories tall. And you just see a lot of sky, and it's quite dry and very bright, very, very bright and sunny. So anytime I come to a city like this that has, I would say, a much more lush environment, you have beautiful old 20-story brick buildings from the 20s and 30s. You have huge parks, and it's very green. There's a tremendous quality of life aspect to Kansas City that probably people just take for granted.
Mm-hmm. What buildings stand out to you, and which buildings do you have questions about?
Oh, well, I haven't seen that much yet to be able to say that effectively. I mean, I did very much admire the World War I memorial and the kind of statement in the landscape that that makes and its relation to the city. I do wonder about the concert hall. You know, it's
the Performing Arts Center.
The Performing Arts Center. Its location somehow and the way it relates to the city is a little unclear to me. And I do think
meaning it stands off on its own a little bit too much as opposed to being integrated into the fabric of the town.
It seems like I can't quite tell what it's addressing. You know, it seems in a strange way a little disconnected from what's around it in
That's
a way that it doesn't really make sense. You know, compared to the old train station or other train stations, which don't really have the same city context they had when they were built. But there's a front somehow, and that front establishes a place in a way that doesn't go away, even though things change around it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think it's more difficult for contemporary architecture to make that kind of statement.
So, our Union Station, do you like it?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
You know, there are several books probably that could still be done about Union Stations all around the country.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, that's John Rubel, co-founder and partner in the firm of Moore, Rubel, Udell Architects and Planners. He'll be speaking this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. The library, see which one?
Plaza.
Downtown. The Plaza Library.
Plaza
okay.
Library.
Okay.
Yep,
RSVP, more information, kclibrary.org. John, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.